I'm sorry, what were you saying, Brian?
So, Hevra.
What was special in Toronto?
I was in Toronto, frankly, to raise some money for Chovevei Torah. One of our
you
key,
were successful, I trust.
Yeah, one of our key supporters is there. And it was a wonderful visit. And once I'm there, I also gave a shiur at Shar Shamayim, which is
Shar Shamayim,
one of the largest synagogues there. And Adam's going to be there this Shabbos, so if they're smart, they'll take him as their next rabbi.
Isn't that
if they're smart. I don't. But I love him more than I love myself, in that sense. He is a great rabbi. I was trying to tell them who Adam was. I can't find the adjectives. He's a great rabbi. And he has this... I've not seen a rabbi, a young rabbi, so well-rounded. He's brilliant. He's brilliant Talmud Chacham.
No, the main thing is that I think the main thing is if he doesn't know something, at least he doesn't pretend to know something. He says he'll look into it and learn, and that's great stuff.
And I think his best quality is that he comes prepared all the time, fully prepared for whatever lesson he's going to teach.
He's a very mature person.
He's got a lot going. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Hodu Lashem et Yitov Ki Le'olam Chasdo Hodu Lashem Ki Yitov Ki Le'olam Chasdo Hodu Lashem Ki Yitov Ki Le'olam Chasdo Hodu Lashem Ki Yitov Ki le'olam chasdo Try that. Hodu Lashem ki yitov ki le'olam chasdo. Hodu Lashem ki yitov ki le'olam chasdo. Hodu Lashem ki yitov ki le'olam chasdo. Hodu Lashem ki yitov ki those words mean Hodu Lashem means praise the Lord, Ki Tov, for He is good, Ki Leolam Chasdo. His kindness, Leolam either means His kindness is eternal, or His kindness envelops the whole world, the whole olam. Hodu Lashem ki yitov ki le'olam chasdo. Hodu Lashem ki yitov ki le'olam chasdo. Some learning.
Right.
Singing before learning is.
Did it at least give you a free shot?
This is his Starbucks. You have to keep going to the Corner Cafe, though. Remember that. I'm a big Corner Cafe fan. I am a Starbucks fan. I think when Harold Schultz was the owner of Starbucks, was thinking, who is crazy enough to buy a coffee for $5. He had me in mind.
Lots of people.
The first time I got a Starbucks, Toby got it for me, and I said, Toby, can you do me a favor? The top two-thirds is all foam. Could you go back and say, I'd like to have a little more coffee? And this was in the beginning, and she comes back, she says, no, that's what it is. It's all foam. And people still buy it. At least I get lactose.
But you're still making money on it, you know that? The people are buying.
At
the same time, oil and goilem, right?
Yeah. It's actually it's an ingenious.
Do they have seats in this?
I don't know if they have seats. I've been there only once. I met the manager. His name is Amnon. I hope it's not coming to shul. Holy Israeli. So we're in chapter 37. And we're in the middle of the story of. In the middle of the story of Joseph. But in honor of Hanukkah, I want to say something on the Joseph story. Hanukkah is beginning next
Tuesday
night. You know what? Maybe I can wait till next week. We'll do it next week because we're getting together again on Tuesday morning. So we're now on page 233. What I'd like to do today is take a look at the sequence of events Joseph is coming out. Before we do that, just quickly.
I'm not sure if I'm Ted or Flora. I think I'm Flora.
I thought you were saying Charlie.
It's Flora. Next week I'll be Charlie.
Minda.
Florence.
Arlene.
Estelle.
No. I want to get down to business now. Chaim and Herschel. So we have to differentiate the Howards.
You asked me initially whether you can call me that. Anyway.
Can I?
Last time. I said no.
Okay, you'll be Howard. You'll be Chaim. Okay, good. Okay, Brindle.
Joe.
What's your first name?
Sava.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for coming. Where are you? Where you live here, or?
Yeah, I live here, but I was in Israel, so I didn't come to the beginning.
Oh, please. It's a joy to have you. Family in Israel?
Friends.
Good. Good. Always feel welcome.
Elaine.
Shlomi Yosef.
Two of you.
Very good. Fischel.
Hiya.
No, I know. Okay. So let's take a look at.
Thanks.
Joseph is coming to the brothers. And in sentence. We're now on page 233. In sentence 18, Vayiru oto me'rochok, page 233. They see Joseph from a distance, far off. Uveterem yikrav aleihem, and before he comes close to them, vayitnaklu oto lamito. They conspire against him to kill him because they see Joseph as a threat, as we've discussed. So what's their first plan? Vayomru ish el achiv, and one said to their brother, Hinei bal hachalomot halazeba, this master of dreams is coming. He's not just a Walter Mitty type dreamer. He is a master of dreams. In other words, what he dreams about, he means business. He's going to take this dream and translate it into reality. Vata lechuvin argeu. Let's go kill him. How will we kill him? V'nashlich, we will kill him. We will kill him. That's what they say. We're going to see him. We're going to choke him. We're going to kill him. And after we kill him, we want to hide the body. How will we hide the body? V'nashlichheu b'chana borot. We're going to throw him into one of the pits. We will say that an evil beast consumed him. We'll see what is going to be with his dreams. So their first plan, they had not done anything yet, but if you could overhear, and the Bible is giving us a glimpse of what they're saying, if we would overhear their conversation, they are conspiring to kill him. Let's kill him. It doesn't say how we'll kill him, but let's kill him. And then we'll get rid of the body, we'll throw him into the pit, and there's no body around. We'll say he's not around because he was consumed by an evil beast. The Midrash says, if this is what you can do to your brother, you may be human beings, but in effect, you are an evil beast. And so it's sort of like it's a double level statement. We will say that an evil beast consumed him. They didn't realize that they may have been talking about themselves. But the simple level here is, let's kill him and throw him to the pit. Sentence 21. Vayishma Ruvain vayatzilehu miyadam. Ruvain hears this and he saves them. He saves Joseph. Vayomen, he says, lo nakenu nafesh. I don't like that idea. We can't kill him. We will not kill him and literally smite his soul, smite his breath. No. Vayoma aleihem Ruvain, and Ruvain says to them, notice by the way, whenever you have two Vayomers, two and he said, and in between there's no response that tells the reader that this is something that should be studied very carefully. Look at the text. Sentence 21, Ruvain heard this and saves Joseph. Vayomer, and Ruvain says, he says three words, lo nakenu nafesh, let us not take his life. So you would think after he said, let us not take his life, that the brothers would respond. There is no response. What does it then say? Again, there is the verb vayomer. Do you see that in sentence 22? Vayoma lehem Ruvain, and Ruvain said to them. Well, if this is really part of the original speech, then why is there the need? After it had said in sentence 21, and Ruvain said, let us not kill him, why is there again the need to say, Vayoma aleihem Ruvain? It's the same speaker. I can only imagine that after Ruvain says, lo nakenu nafesh, that request was met with silence. They look at him like, are you crazed? He's a threat. He's getting no response. And so whenever you have two Vayomers and it's the same speaker and there's no response to that speaker, generally it means that there's silence in between. Vayoma aleihem Ruvain, and Ruvain said to them, and now he spells it out, Al tishpichu dam. We can't with our own hands spill his blood. Al tishpichu dam. But you know what we should do? Let's not kill him. But rather, Hashlichu oto el habor. We will cast him into the pit alive, Asheb Amidbar, which is in the desert. V'yod al tishlechuvo. That way, at least, he's arguing we will not directly kill him. Now, I guess if they were to do this, they could be hauled into a court of law and they could be tried for some degree of homicide. I'm not a lawyer, but there probably is some difference. There may be, in actuality, not much of a difference, but there's a difference between literally killing someone and taking the human being alive and throwing him into the pit and then he dies. Again, there's not much difference, but he's trying to reason with them. How could you kill him with your own hands?
Kind of second-degree murder.
Second degree, or whatever it is. Now, of course, Reuven has his own idea. Now the Bible chimes in and says, why is Reuven offering this second suggestion? Leman atzilo tomi adam, in order to save Joseph from their hands, because if he'd be killed, he'd be dead. If he's into the pit and he's still alive, then he can take him out. La shivo el aviv. That is what Reuven had intended to do. But it appears that there were two steps. They look up, they see Joseph, and their first step is, let's kill him. My mother used to say, I'll crown you. I'm not sure to this day exactly what that means, but that doesn't sound good. I'll kill you. I'm going to get you. I'll crown you. I got to look that up. I'll crown you. And that's what they say. We're going to crown Yosef. We're going to take care of him. And then Ruvain says, no, let's not do it that way. Let's not kill him directly with our hands. Let's throw him into the pit. He'll die in the pit. And that's less, he hopes, that's less of direct murder. And of course, Reuven's intent was to then go to the pit and save him. Brindle.
There are two things. In the first part, Reuven says, Lo nikane nefesh. He includes himself. Let us not take somebody's
That's
life.
That's very true.
But there, in the second one, he says, Al tishpachu dam. He tells it to them, don't you?
That's beautiful, Brindle. Brindle's offering something very beautiful, that in his first comment, he's part of the group. In the second comment, he now has separated himself from the group. Now that is worth a Medal of Honor. That is good stuff, Brindle.
From
Harold.
The president.
what I don't understand is, if I said that, I want to be president of the United States, people wouldn't exactly take me seriously that I was actually a threat that this Nudnik is going to become president of the United States, and I'm a threat to the country, and I'm going to throw me in the pit, a metaphorical pit. But the brothers took him seriously.
He did.
Why did they take him so seriously?
That
they were ready to kill him.
I'll tell you why they took him seriously. Just some suggestions. They took him seriously. They took him seriously for several reasons. One, they know family history. And they know that the family history has been that the inheritance of covenant, the inheritance of what in Hebrew is called the Brit, always went to the younger brother. And they see Joseph as being the younger brother. Benjamin was just an infant then, so it's Joseph. That's one reason. Secondly, they saw in Joseph somebody who was alert, who was smart, he was aggressive, and he's dreaming. And thirdly, it's Jacob who made them take Joseph seriously, because Jacob shows favoritism to Joseph, and Joseph is the eldest from Rachel. Rachel is the favored wife of Jacob. And Jacob gives Yosef the ketonet pasim, the coat of many colors. And they know very well, when you get that coat, that is the sign of kingship. It's like someone had mentioned, it's like the king wearing, or the queen wearing, a particular kind of uniform, a particular kind of coat. Now that's not a coat that he picked up in the 5 and 10 store. That's a coat that Jacob gave to him. And so they take it very, very seriously. And when the text says, after Joseph's dream, Vaviv Shamarit HaDavar, which is normatively translated to mean, and Jacob watched the matter, so it's normatively understood to mean that Jacob watched to make sure that there wouldn't be too much of a rift between the two. But the deeper interpretation is that Jacob watched the matter because he felt that what Joseph had to say had some credence. The brothers probably picked up in the body language of Jacob that he was favoring Joseph, and this alarmed them. This concerned them. Now, when I say, and this is the Sepharno say that they saw Joseph as a threat, I think it's understandable that they saw Joseph as a threat, but that in no way justifies what they did to Joseph. Because you have an understanding of something doesn't mean that we're justified in taking the actions that we take. So it may be understandable that they saw that Joseph was ready to usurp their power, but what the brothers do here is, of course, it's horrific. It's beyond the pale.
And then they sit down and have a feast. Lechem, lechem, lechem.
But obviously, they're not punished, because at the end they all
get together.
They all get together in the new tribe.
We have to talk about that, because my sense is that this sale was a sale, that after 22 years, finally, Joseph is going to reveal himself. Mm-hmm. But I'm not at all convinced that they made true peace. The peace that they made, Joseph and the brothers, was an external peace. It was a surface peace. Sometimes we can have a disagreement with someone who is very close. And remember when we were kids, you'd have a disagreement in camp. If you ever went to camp, okay, shake hands and make up. Sometimes it's not so simple. You can shake hands, they shake hands. He says, I'm Joseph, don't feel so bad, although he sticks it to them a little bit. And then he says, it was God's plan. But to the end, especially after Jacob dies, the Bible says the brothers were very wary of Joseph, that Joseph never forgot what they had done to him. And Joseph was wary of the brothers. And it's my contention that, from each of the sons of Jacob, this is a patriarchal work, there emerged the tribes. Reuven, there's a tribe of Reuven. Shimon, Simeon, there's the tribe of Simeon. Judah, there's the tribe of Judah. Joseph, is there a tribe of Joseph?
No.
There is no tribe of Joseph. And the reason I believe there is no tribe of Joseph is you can only be a tribe, Labriut, you can only be a tribe if you potentially can live in unity with the other tribes. And deep down, Joseph could never live in peace with his brethren. The pain of this hit was so great, it could not be completely fixed. And often it is the case, I'm sitting with people with great wisdom of life, often it is the case that what we can't do in our lives, we can't accomplish everything in our lives. Often what we can't do is left to our children to do. And that is why while there is no tribe of Joseph, Joseph has two sons, Menashe and Ephraim. There is a tribe of Menashe, and there is a tribe of Ephraim. Perhaps they, into the future, would be able to live with other tribes. That's why I believe Moses does not enter into the land of Israel. It was not only the rock incident. That's too narrow. He doesn't enter into the land of Israel for a lot of reasons. Amongst them, I think it teaches that even Moses, who may have had aspirations and plans in life, even he could not achieve and realize all of his dreams. In fact, his greatest dream was left unrealized. And who was it left to? It was left to the next generation. It was left to Joshua. So in answer to the question, this is a terrible, terrible break. And I'm not sure it's a break. I'm convinced it was a break that in their lifetime was never repaired. And I think the challenge in the rest of the Bible is to see whether, in fact, the Jewish people coming from Joseph, Ephraim and Menashe, whether they could live with the others. And the Tanakh indicates that it was a great struggle, and we're still struggling to this day. Annapolis is opening today, mm-hmm. and there's tremendous conflict within the Jewish community, hard conflict. And people saying hard things about each other. People have different opinions about it. Is it
not really? You think so?
Yes.
You know, I'm in a different space now where I have very strong, Harold, I have very strong opinions about it, but I'm different that A, I'm not going to tell you what the opinions are now as I'm learning, and B, I don't put down people who disagree with me anymore. I realize that they can love Israel and they can be passionate about Israel just as much as I am passionate about Israel. There was a time where I could see anybody had a different view of what to do for the welfare of Israel. Those are the people who don't care about Israel. But a lot of people around this table who had different political views than mine have taught me, so you're my rebbes, that you can have different views and you could be just as passionate. I think about Jesse, he has very different views than I have about the land of Israel. But let me tell you,
everything.
He loves Israel and has taught me about love of Israel. He's had a great influence on my life in a very, very profound way. So, yes, please.
I want to go back to the pit. this was almost a challenge to God.
Yeah.
If we'll put him in the pit. If God wants to see him take over and really be... God will take care of him somehow. You know, they're not going to do it. They're not going to kill him. And let God save him in however the divine plan is. Almost challenging the divine plan. Is there a divine plan? Will it ultimately be?
That's a great point. It's actually hinted at, if we take a look at the end of sentence 20, they say, let's throw him into the pit. We'll say that a wild beast consumed him. Then you have these four words, v'nireh ma'yihi yuchalamotav. Some suggest that this is really God speaking. God says, okay, throw him in and we'll see what will be of his dreams. You think he'll die? There's a divine plan here. He's going to be saved. Yes, Phil?
Joseph is...
By the way, this pit, imagery of the pit, Phil, before I forget, these days I forget, I'm forgetting quickly. Think about it. Jacob dreams of ladders, mm-hmm. angels going up, mm-hmm. angels coming down. He's not chalming. He's now being. And then he dreams. He dreams of stars. Dream lofty dreams. And Nebuch, what do? They throw him into the pit. They throw him down. This is imagery, poetic imagery in the Bible. That's very, very important. Yes.
Joseph and his brothers.
In other words, now I'm interrupting you for the second time. In other words, you're dreaming. The brothers are saying, when they choose. Now you said, I'm going to go back to the pit. That's what really triggered it. They say to Joseph, you're dreaming because you think you're a Jacob. Jacob dreams of the ladder that's on the ground that goes up to the heavens. This guy's dreaming in two dreams what Jacob dreamt in one dream. He's dreaming of sheaves on the ground and stars. They're saying to Joseph, you think you're dreaming of the heavens? You think you're going to go up there? We're going to show you. Why are they throwing him into the pit? Why that imagery? I think they're trying to turn the dream on its head. They're saying, we're not going to let you dream of heavens. We're gonna put you beneath the ground. That's what we're going to be doing to you. Phil, no more interrupting. God, I'm sorry.
Joseph is and his brothers, they're not killing him necessarily because he's favored by his father. But Joseph is an exceptional person, almost unique person, brilliant, beyond anybody else, has very little humility, okay? And this is what they're contending with. Somebody who is so much more intelligent than they are. How do we know that? We know it because when he goes to Egypt, he is singled out to be the second to the Pharaoh.
Right.
So he is not just a nice guy who got a lucky break, but he's a guy who's exceptionally brilliant, and anybody who meets him realizes that.
Right.
But by the time the Pharaoh gets to him, he's already got some humility.
Right.
Because he's suffered plenty already.
I think it's a very, very good point. Joseph on his own. Let's take a couple of sentences. Sentence 23. So they had two plans. First, they were going to kill him with their hands. Then they say, no. Reuven says, no. Let's throw him in a pit. He'll die in a pit. Sentence 23. Vayikashev b'Yosef el Achav. And Joseph, when Joseph came to his brethren, v'yafshitu et Yosef et kutanto. They take off his coat. They have to take off his coat. At ketonet apasim asher alav. It would have been enough to say they take off his coat. No, they take off the ketonet pasim, the coat of many colors. This is the coat of kingship that his father had given him. They take it off him.
He was defrocked.
He was defrocked. And my sense is they could not be rid of him until he took his coat off. That's biblical language. Saul is not going to have the kingship removed from him until Samuel is going to rip his coat. When King David rips Saul's coat, when he's in the cave there, you know it's the end of Saul. Maybe hold on for a couple more years, but if you wear the coat, then you've got the leadership. This is biblical language. Coat represents leadership. Coat represents political leadership. That's why we said last week, the Hebrew for coat is beged. Beged is a boged. It's almost a deception, because politics is so suffused by definition with you can't in satisfying everyone, often you can't be absolutely honest. So they take off his coat, and vayikachuhu, and they take him, vayashlichu oto habora, they throw him into the pit, vahabor reik, and the pit was empty. Ein bo mayim, there is no water. The rabbis ask, would it not have been enough to save Abo Reik and the pit was empty? Why does it say Ein Bo Mayim? Because they understand this to mean that really it wasn't empty. It was empty in the sense that it did not have water, but it had other stuff in it. If it would have said Abo Reik, it was empty, it would mean that there's nothing in the pit. It says no, Abo Reik Ein Bo Mayim. It was empty in the sense that it had no water. Often pits have the bottom of it, it have water. It has no water, but as Bev is saying, what did it have? It had scorpions. Mm-hmm. I had a Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. He says that there's a very wonderful teaching from here. The teaching is, nature abhors a vacuum. So if I don't pour water into this cup, space is going to immediately space is immediately going to fill the cup, because space abhors a vacuum. If you don't pour something in, if you're not going to have water in the pit, there's going to be other stuff that's going to be in the pit, and that's going to be snakes and scorpions. I was talking to a young a while back, God forbid mentioning any names. You know, someone just struggling with his own particular life, and substance abuse is a very, very real problem. And as we were talking, it became clear that this individual, although trying to get help, still is seeking meaning. Doesn't feel like this person says, I'm not finding meaning in life. And then shared with me that, this person's not even from here. This person shared with me, and he said, Rabbi, that I now really almost made the mistake in imbibing again, in drinking or drugs or whatever it is. And I said to him, I want you to know something. I'm very concerned. And the reason I'm concerned is that the reason you didn't drink again is because something happened that frightened you, which means that you still want it, and if it's not going to be there to frighten you, you're going to take it. And what I'm especially concerned about is that you're saying you don't find meaning in life, and it's precisely because you haven't found meaning in life that you're looking for meaning in an external, superficial way that often occurs. And I gave him this example. I said, if you're not going to fill your life with that which is productively meaningful, then you're going to fill it with crap. You're going to fill it with other stuff. So this is an example, by the way, of a phrase within the Bible that you can take this phrase and take it out of the flow of the narrative of this text and just try to think about some kind of teaching relative that impacts upon life. So they throw him into the pit. Vayeshfu lecho lechem. And they sit to eat bread. This sentence is so disturbing. It's one thing to throw your brother in the pit. Although the Bible doesn't say what Joseph was doing, what must have he been doing?
Praying
or screaming.
Fasting.
Or
fasting.
Pleading. Fasting. Something. Fasting, okay. He may have been davening, but he could be screaming for life. And what are they doing? They're sitting and they're eating bread. And when the Bible says they're eating bread, that means bread is a euphemism. They're having a big meal. L'havdil elef alfei havdalot. There's nothing to do with this. You know the stories back 50, 60 years ago, they would take the Jews to the slaughter and the Germans would be listening to Wagner. They're very sophisticated.
And eating
and partying. Correct. That's not the story, but this is very alarming. Vayishvu lecho lechem. Then vayisu einayim. They lift up their eyes. Vayiru, and they see. Vihine orchak yishma'ilim. There's a caravan of yishma'ilim. We can't, what's that song? I'm going to wash that man out of my head. We can't get rid of Yishmael. He's back again. Behold, there's a caravan of Ishmaelites. Ba'a mi Gilad. Coming from Gilad. Ugmaleim nosim. And their camels were carrying all kinds of perfumes. Nechot, utsri, volot. Hochim lo rid mitzrayma. They're bringing all these perfumes down to Egypt. Vayomer Yehuda el Achav. Now Yehuda steps to the plate. He's the cleanup hitter. He's number four. Yehuda says to their brethren, Ma benza ki naharog et achinu. What profit is there that we kill our brothers? We may not be killing him literally, but if we threw him into the pit and he dies, we are responsible. What do we gain by killing our brothers? V'chisinu et damo, and we will cover up his blood by saying that he was consumed by a wild beast. L'chu v'nim kirenu la'ishmaelim. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. V'yodenu al tivo. Let not our hand be cast upon him. Ki achinu b'sarenu ho. The word ach, brother, is found so many times in the sentence. He is our brother. He is our flesh. V'yishma'u echav, and their brethren heard what Yehuda said. So this is the third step. First step is, let's kill him with our hands. Second step, not with our hands, let's throw him into the pit and he'll die. That was Reuven's idea. Third step is Yehuda's. What was Yehuda's plan? Let's sell him. Let's not let him die in the pit. Let's sell him. And the brothers seem to listen. And then the text says, Vayavru anashim midyanim socharim. And Midianite merchants passed by Yamshichu, and they draw Vayalu at Yosef min Abor. They lift Joseph from the pit. Vayimkeru at Yosef la Yishmaelim. They sell Joseph to the Yishmaelim. Besrim Kosef. Vayaviu et Yosef Mitzrayim. I'm just reading a few more sentences, and then I want you to think of all kinds of questions. And they take Joseph to Egypt. Vayashav Reuven el Habor. Reuven then returns to the pit. Where have you been, Reuven, by the way? Vine and Yosef Babor. And Joseph is not in the pit. Vayikrat begadav. Reuven rents his garment. He tears his garments. Vayashav el Achav. Vayomar. He returns. Reuven does to his brethren, and he says, Hayeled Einenu. The child is missing. Vani ona aniva. What will become of me? I stop here. I need your reflections. And Harold, you look like you're plotting
again. First thing I can't even give that.
Right, okay.
At any rate, there must have been some kind of agreement between the 11 brothers, whatever it was, 11 brothers?
Ten brothers.
No. Between the 10 brothers to have this, because it's a conspiracy, essentially, against Joseph.
Good point.
And it seems as though there was such harmony that they're willing to accept. Like some countries often have, North Korea is going to have a committee when the head of North Korea dies, that it wouldn't be left to one person, but that it would be dispersed amongst the 10 brothers, and they had that agreement amongst them, that's the way they wanted it. Because they're acting in such concert, and there's so little dissension amongst them in terms of what they want to do to the person who is their...
It was their enemy.
That's a wonderful point, Harold. And there is a lot of discussion on exactly what you're talking about. Were the brothers really absolutely united in what they're doing to Joseph? Because amongst the brothers were, was Reuven. And Reuven seems to be especially concerned for the welfare of Joseph as the eldest. He thought that he bears responsibility. We spoke about this last week. Amongst the brothers was also Judah.
Right.
Now, Judah also felt a special responsibility because Reuven knew he was not going to be the covenantal heir because he had slept inappropriately with his father's wife, with Bilhah. And Shimon and Levi were not going to, the second and the third, they were not going to inherit because they had killed off the whole city of Shechem. That's nothing to write home about. So here, Judah, it's interesting that Reuven and Judah are the ones who are coming forth to defend Joseph. And amongst the ten, there wasn't 12 because Benjamin was too young to be there, were also four sons who were the children of the concubines. And the text implies that Joseph had cared for the concubines to protect them from the children of Leah. So one wonders, maybe those four were also on Joseph's side. You wonder, maybe there was enough within the group that was setting out to sell Yosef that maybe would defend and make sure that that would not happen. All of this is really open for discussion. The other way to look at it is that as much as there was dissension amongst them, they had one thing in common. They all did not like Joseph. It's like today. Arab countries don't like each other, but there's one thing they're united about. They're united in their hostility towards Israel, and often that is what brings them together. Great point. Estelle?
Just one question. I don't know which is worse, selling somebody into slavery or mercifully killing him. Some people might prefer the latter rather than the former.
It's interesting also that he says...
So it's a good idea.
It's also an Ishmaelite caravan, because we've gone through this. We know that Ishmael was the son of Abraham, who was not going to be the covenantal heir. Isaac was going to inherit. So when they say there's a caravan of Ishmaelites, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, is this their way of saying Joseph is not going to be the heir? Now, what I'm disturbed about is the following. In Sentence 25, it says, and they sat to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes, and behold, they see a caravan of Ishmaelites with all of these perfumes. Then Judah says, let's sell him. Now, in Sentence 28, something is mentioned here that is disturbing. It says, Vayavru anashim midyanim socharim. Wait a minute. Where do the Midianites come from? Follow me for a second. They lifted up their eyes and they see Ishmaelites. But when it comes down to it, what does it say in sentence 28? That there were Midianites men who passed, merchants, Vayimshechu vayalu et Yosef min habor. So it doesn't seem to make any sense here.
Did they see the Midianites as Ishmael? a substitution of what Ishmael stood for?
That's a good question.
How convenient.
Were the Midianites and Ishmaelites close enough so that their names could be used interchangeably?
Right.
You see, the problem that I have is, problem that many commentators have, is that they look up and they see an Ishmaelite caravan, they say, let's sell them. But when it comes down to it, in sentence 22, Midianite men pass by, and then Vayamshichu, so when it says that they lifted him, and they drew him, and they lifted him from the pit, who is the subject? Who does that? Let's take a look at sentence 28. It says in sentence 28, and they were passed by Midianites merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph. Who drew and lifted up Joseph?
The Ishmaelites may have lifted him up.
It sounds, Brenda, when you're of course right, but when you look at the sentence, it would seem, who does it?
The Midianites.
Yeah.
But they sold him.
But wait a minute. Which point did Reuben look into the pit and see it empty? If they're lifting him out of the pit, where was he?
They lifted him out of the pit, and the caravan sets off to take Joseph to Egypt.
And then
Reuven returns to the pit. It's all very, very complicated when you think about it. Let me tell you what Rashi says. Rashi, of course, is the 11th century commentator. He's the greatest of the commentators because he had the capacity. His commentary is meant for a child and is meant for the doctoral student and beyond. He had the ability to say complicated ideas in pithy, simple words. If I could follow one person around in history, I'd like to follow Rashi. I'd like to see the way he lived. I'd like to see the way he studied, how he wrote. Brilliant commentator. And says the great Rashi, quoting the Midrash, you see, Rashi was a master of the elliptical clause. The elliptical clause means that he looks at a text and he says that there are words missing in the text, and he reads words into the text. And the words that he reads into the text, for Rashi, is part of the literal flow of the text. Let me give an example. First words of the Bible. The Bible says, Bereshit bara Elohim. What are the first words of the Bible? What are the first words in English?
In the beginning,
God created. Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. But that's not what Breshit means. If it is really in the beginning, what's the Hebrew Arlene for in the beginning? Barosh, not Breshit. Breshit with a tough is in the construct state. Breshit literally means in the beginning of. So if we were to really translate that phrase, the phrase means in the beginning of God created. Wait a minute, Rashi says. There's a word missing. In the beginning of what? Says Rashi. Read it, Breshit Hakol. In the beginning of everything, God created. That is Rashi on the elliptical clause. We were studying Midrash last week about Cain and Abel. It says, Vayome Cain al Hevel Ochiv. Cain said to Abel, his brother. Then it says that Cain rose, Vayakom Kayim. Cain rises and he kills Abel. Rashi's jaw drops and he says, well, what did Cain say to Abel? Rashi writes, there's a lot of different thoughts as to what he said, and he spells it out, or he alludes to what Cain says to Abel. That's what being a master of the elliptical clause means. An elliptic is something, it's two diagrams, it's two figures, but they're not connected. There's something missing in between. The clause sounds obtuse, but he adds something to it. So here's what Rashi does. Rashi, on sentence 28, understands it as follows. Vayavru anashim mijanim socharim. And at that time, Midianite merchants were passing by. Stop. We've got to add words. And the words are, and the Ishmaelites came, and they lifted Joseph out of the pit. And indeed the brothers sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites. Vayimkru et Yosef leIshmaelim be'esrim kasef. And what did the Ishmaelites do? Then they in turn sold Joseph to the Midianites. That's why in sentence 36 it says, Vahamidanim, which is really the Midianites, Vahamidanim machru et
Machru Oto El Mitzrayim. Let me see if I can put my hand on the Rashi.
How can they tell the difference?
I'm sorry?
How can they tell the difference? I mean, basically.
Between the Midianites and that's a great question.
I think they probably wear clothing signs or something like that. Different
costume,
you know, different
sorrow. But they're basically
on the back of the camel, they have "I love Midian."
Look at what Rashi says. Rashi actually says it differently than what I just said. I offered what some commentators say. This is what Rashi says on sentence 28. And they're passed by Midianites. This is another caravan. And the text informs you that he was sold many times. Oh. Then the text says, "Vayim shechu," and they drew him, according to what Rashi is saying, "Vayim shechu," who drew him? "B'nei Yaakov et Yosef min habor." The children of Jacob lifted Joseph from the boar, and they sold him to whom?
Ishmaelites.
To the Ishmaelites. And the Ishmaelites sold him to the Midianites.
He's just reading.
And the Midianites sold him to... to Egypt. Could you imagine?
He's rational.
So let's look back at sentence 28. If you look at this sentence, it looks like the Midianites were the ones who kidnapped him, who drew him out. Rashi says differently than what I said before. That there were Midianites in the area. Now, stop. Now the brothers drew and lifted Joseph out of the pit. And it was the brothers who sold him to the Ishmaelites. And it was the Ishmaelites who then sold him to the Midianites. And it was the Midianites who then sold him to the Egyptians. That is what Rashi says. I'll read it again.
With respect to Rashi, it makes no sense.
The sons of Jacob drew Joseph from the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites to the Midianites, and the Ishmaelites and the Midianites to the... Wow.
How would you answer the question?
You know what? No,
Arlene, I'm sorry.
Estelle, how would she answer the question?
I mean,
that
he's just
raised?
Reading things into it. This is crazy.
But then how would you answer the questions that we ask? That we are just questioning what's written here.
Would you say he's using logic, though? Or would you say he's divinely inspired?
One person buys something for resale. They don't buy it to keep. You buy it for resale.
But if this is supposed,
maybe they have done.
In other words, you had the wholesalers, the retailers.
if this is supposedly written by God, as you say, why should they read something into it?
Let me try to contemporize this for a moment, and then I want to give you a different take on it, and then we're going to leave this. Another take. This was, in biblical terms, this was a major action. And it was a terrible, terrible action. Something terrible is unfolding. And one thing I think we've learned in contemporary times now, what I'm about ready to say is, Lahavdil elef alfei havdalot. Here we're talking about Joseph and his brothers. So let me talk about something very, very different. I'm talking about something very different. I'm saying this for the third time. Think about a terrorist act. I mean, one has to... I think everyone understands that when a terrorist, God forbid, commits an action, chances of it being the action of a lone person is not great. I was down in Argentina in 94 when they bombed the Amia Jewish Community Center. It was the greatest terrorist attack outside of Israel since the Shoah. I mean, it's somebody drove up and had a truck full of explosives, rammed it into the gates, and the building collapsed. And 86 people were killed. So when you look at that, naively one could say it was one person. He bought some explosives, put it into the truck, and finished. Of course, that's not what happened. It's much, much more complicated. And much more, the intrigue was much more complicated. Now we know, for example, that it was all planned in the Iranian mission, literally, in Buenos Aires. I keep telling that to Blumberg. He thinks it's safe to have some of these missions that are terrorist states. Who knows what they're planning in their offices? I'm serious about that. Who knows? It's complex. That's why in Israel they're so strong on who was the driver who brought the terrorist in, who provides the arms, and this and that. Now, of course, this is something different, but it's still a terrible act. And when Rashi says, and you're kidding around a little bit, but you're right, that there was the retailers and the wholesalers, and, you know, what it's saying is, hey, this is a desert. You know, you go to the desert, you look up, and what do you see? You see, hey, they look up, they see Ishmaelites. Then the text informs us, and by the way, there were Midianites there as well, right? And so they're all in the area. It's like a bazaar of people. And then the brothers decide they don't want to kill Joseph. They want to sell him. So what do? They pick him up out of the pit, and who they sell him to? They sell him to the Ishmaelites. They were there. And then the Ishmaelites, they were Midianites, they sell him to the Midianites. Because the text says in sentence 39, as I pointed out, that it was the Midianites who sold him to, who sold him into Egypt. And that's the way Rashi, see, what Rashi is saying is,
that's why you have,
and Egypt kept him.
Why can't they accept
the retailer, and the final consumer?
Okay, and the final consumer. Now, in honor of Estelle, I want to offer an alternative. And here's the alternative. And the alternative is not mine. It's said by the Rashbam, the grandson of Rashi. And well, this will end. And I want you to follow me for a moment. Their first plan was to kill him. We're going to crown him. Second plan was, we can't kill him directly. We'll throw him into the pit. He'll die in the pit. Third plan. What was their third plan? They look up and they see Ishmaelites. What was Judah's plan? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Then the text says, let's take a look at the beginning. Let's take a look at sentence 25. Back up again. First they say, let's kill him. Then what do they say? Let's throw him into the pit. Sentence 25, Vayeshvu lecho lechem, says Rashbam, do you think they could have a feast right near the pit? I think Rashbam says they may have been evil, but to have a feast right near the pit where Joseph was in agony and crying out, and so, okay, but Rashbam's interpretation, they must have been a distance from the pit. Now, if you've ever been in a desert, you could be 100 feet away. If it's over a hill, you might as well be 1,000 miles away. Somehow that's what occurs in a desert. 100 feet could be a tremendous distance. They're far away. And they lift up their eyes, and they see an Ishmaelite caravan. And then Judah says, let's sell them to the Ishmaelites. I'm up to sentence 28. And as they are about 100, 200, maybe 500 feet, that's not so far. That's the distance from home plate to the deepest part of center field in the old Yankee Stadium. They're not far away. It's not that far away. It's pretty, but it's not that far. And they see Ishmaelites, and now they have a third plan. We're not going to kill them directly. We're not going to leave them in the pit. We're going to sell them to the Ishmaelites. And they're over a little bit of a hill, and unbeknown to them who comes,
the Midianites
come. And what do the Midianites do? They, the Midianites, that's what the text says.
Yeah.
The Midianites pull him out, and what do? The Midianites pull him out, and they kidnap him. And to whom do the Midianites sell him? To the other caravan that was in the area. They sell him to the Ishmaelites. So from that perspective, did the brothers ever sell Joseph? From that perspective, the brothers never ever sold Joseph. And that is why Reuven is with the brothers. He's 500 feet away. He's the eldest. He comes to take a look to see where Joseph is. Vayashav Reuven, and suddenly Joseph is not in the pit. He's not in the pit because who had kidnapped him? He'd been kidnapped by the Midianites. In fact, there is a teaching that says that whenever in the Bible has the verb and he or she or they heard, but doesn't say what they heard, it means that you hear but you don't listen. So when the text says in sentence 27, where Judah rises and proclaims, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let us not cast our hand against him because he is our brother, the text then says, Vayishma'u Echav, and his brethren hearkened unto him. The deeper meaning of this is they hearkened to him, they heard him, but the brothers were saying at that point, you know, maybe we shouldn't even do this. And if you look at the flow from this perspective, it is looking as if, now one person's understanding is another person's rationalization, But one person's rationalization is another person's understanding. It looks as if, according to Rashbam, the brothers were constantly changing their minds. For Rashbam, there were four steps. The first step, let's kill him. Second step, we can't do that. Let's throw him into the pit. He'll die in the pit. Third step, let's sell him. Fourth step, let's not even sell him. When Judah proposes, let's sell him, the brothers hear, but they don't listen because deep down they're saying, even this is something we should not do. And then unbeknown to the brothers, the Midianites come. They're the ones who kidnap Joseph. Then the brothers come back to the pit, led by Reuven. Joseph is not in the pit, and in fact they say, oh my God, where is he? And from this perspective, the brothers, deep down, they never ever knew what happened to Joseph. For 22 years, they really did not know what had happened to Joseph, because they knew he was in the pit, but he was no longer in the pit. And if you look at the flow of the text, they were not the ones who lifted him out of the pit. So when they come before their father, they're really in a bind. They're in a bind because they really don't know what happened.
So Hashem played a good
what happened
this time, right?
To say that the Midianites pulled him out and sold him to the Ishmaelites doesn't make sense.
Well,
of course, in sentence 36 it says, and the Midianites were the ones that sold him to Egypt.
Right now, no, but let me. You are apt, and this, the, Charles, it's a great point, and the commentators go ballistic on this stuff. And just to say how complicated it gets, chapter 38 is an intervening chapter of Tamar. We pick up the story on page 241, chapter 39, sentence 1. The Yosef who rad Mitzrayma, and Joseph was brought to Egypt by Iknehu Potipha Sris Paro Sarat Abachim Ish Mitzri, and Potipha bought him from whom? Miyad?
Hayishmelim.
Oh, wait a minute. It just said that the Midianites sold him. Yeah. That first sentence of chapter 39 directly contradicts the last sentence of chapter 37. It's one big mess, and everybody tries to sort out the mess. Rashi tries to sort it out. Ramban tries to sort it out. And Rashbam tries to sort it out. I mean, the best I can tell you, Charles, is that when it says Vahamidanim, it would mean that ultimately they were the ones who were responsible. Because they were the ones who kidnapped him. They sold him to the Ishmaelites. For all the Ishmaelites knew, maybe he had belonged to the Midianites. The Midianites were the ones who were the culprits in that they lifted him from the pit. And that's why it says, Vamadanim machru oto. Notice it says, Vamadanim machru oto al Mitzrayim. The Midianites sold him to Egypt because they were the prime movers. In chapter 39, sentence 1, it says, Potipha bought him from the hands of the Ishmaelites. Because the Midianites sold him to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites transferred him over by hand. To Potiphar, and that's the way.
I have another question.
Yes. Okay, we get all your questions, and that's what you're going to. And Bill's got a question. Okay.
Slavery, I don't understand the ethics or the morality of that time, and perhaps you could explain it, because I really thought about this and don't understand it. Slaves were people of another race or another culture or the results of capture and war. How does a young man who is of the same basic Semitic background as these other people,
that's what I put.
How does he turn around and become a slave? Is there no protest that he can make in that sense? And he just seems to accept his slavery without too much argument about it.
First of all, it's a great question. And I think he had great problems with becoming a slave. And as we go through the Joseph story, he does protest. He protests mightily. But their hatred of Joseph, their believing that Joseph was out to take what was rightfully theirs, was so great that they were saying exactly what you were saying. You know something? We're going to make him an outsider. He is such a threat, although born to Jacob and Rachel, we're going to make him an Eved. We're going to make him a slave. That's the only way we can remove him from the scene. And that's a great tragedy.
Yes. I want to know why you keep saying they kidnapped him from the pit. Why you are not saying they saved him from the pit. Because that would color the story very differently. Are you translating directly the word
The reason I use the word kidnap is because I think you're correct that, in fact, it says they drew him vayimshichu. That's the exact terminology. Vayimshichu vayalu. They lifted Joseph from the bor, but then it does say they lifted him and they sold him to the Ishmaelites. They're taking a free human being, they're taking him, and then they're selling him to someone else.
But that's not a kidnap. Well, that's a
right.
Saving. If they didn't do that, he might.
But going into slavery,
they might, you know,
it's a
he
saving.
Might die.
It's a saving of his life, but it's a kidnapping in that it's not. You know, kidnapping normally is one kidnaps, God forbid, a child and holds the child. But kidnapping, I think, in a looser sense, is I can take a child, and if I transfer the child, God forbid, to someone else, I've kidnapped that child.
Can I?
Yes, Phil, please.
About Estelle's concern about it not being your interpretation, not being literal. The Bible is not like a Charles Dickens novel. So when it just gives you some elements, like if you were on a psychiatrist's couch and you were telling a story, you would just tell certain phrases. And that's what we get in the narrative of the Bible. We have to fill in, somebody has to fill in the rest of it. You know.
It's interesting imagery that you give about you know, the PowerPoints being given on that psychiatrist's couch, or the ramblings, and then somebody has to put it all together. But what you say is something that I wanted to emphasize, and that is there is beautiful literature out there. Charles Dickens and others, Shakespeare. It's beautiful. There's beautiful literature. There's beautiful writing. It's something that you know, I'm sensitive to. We all must be sensitive to. But the Bible does have, while I think the Bible could be analyzed from a literary perspective, and it is, it's beautiful writing, it's powerful writing, but still yet it has its own unique style. And I think you have touched upon it. Now, it's often very difficult. We're so accustomed to reading our newspapers and our novels, and we're conditioned to read it in a certain way. Here, we're in a very, very different mindset. And I don't say that so that when we go through whatever the Bible says, we should allow any words to go unquestioned. Our role is to look and to question and to learn and to grow, but it's something to bear in mind. Thank you. Estelle.
I know, but to get back to the...
By the way, Estelle, you would agree with me in sentence 28. Mm-hmm. Just look at sentence 28. If you can read to me sentence 28 in English, good. In their past... sentence 28.
And there passed by Midianites merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites.
Now, I want to take it from your perspective, Estelle. I have great respect for you. Now, Estelle, in this sentence, reading it the way you read it, it says, and now this is after the brothers had seen the Ishmaelites in the distance. After the text said that the brothers said, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. That was in a previous sentence. Now it says, and there passed by Midianite merchants. Let's just read the text. And they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit. Who's the they?
The merchantmen.
Who?
The
Midianites. You would agree, it's the Midianites. And the text says, I'm not reading into the text, and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites. So who does this? The Midianites lift him out, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites.
Notice the 22 of Sodom.
Wait, and they, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. So clearly, I mean, when one looks at the sentence, it's the Midianites who sell him to the Ishmaelites. Now, I know the Ishmaelites were in the area. Sometimes this is a style of the Bible. Something will be mentioned beforehand so that we can understand a later text. The Ishmaelites, we were told, were in the area. So the Midianites sell them to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites sell them to Egypt. Now, and as a matter of fact, in the beginning of chapter 39, it says that Potiphar bought him from the hands of the Ishmaelites.
Right.
That's exactly what happened.
Right.
The only problematic text we have is the one that Charles pointed out, that at the end of sentence 37, it says that the Midianites had sold him. And there I think that there's a difference between saying the Midianites sold... Who in the end was responsible for this? Who was responsible for taking Joseph's freedom, if you look at it from this perspective? Not the Ishmaelites.
The
and maybe not even the brothers.
Yeah.
It's the Midianites who look into the pit and lift him. So the Midianites sold him. They're the ones who sold him to Egypt. They're responsible. In the beginning of chapter 39, what we're being told is that Joseph was transferred by hand from the hands of the Ishmaelites to Potiphar. And this interpretation, it's the interpretation of the grandson of Rashi Rashbam, is the literal meaning of this whole text. And from this literal perspective, the brothers were really never sure what happened to Joseph. Never sure.
Going
through human nature, you said that the brothers went through four stages. First they wanted to kill him, then they wanted to throw him in the pit, and then they wanted to sell him,
and then they had second thoughts about that.
Isn't this the way of human nature? Somebody is very angry for the moment and then gradually cools off. Isn't that the way you would interpret the brothers doing that? That they're gradually cooling off and gradually coming back to them, to their normal way of life?
I agree. That's exactly, this interpretation speaks to that point.
The brothers got no financial gain out of
Throughout history,
Jews have been blamed
for
selling Joseph for 20 silvers. But when you read the literal meaning of this text, it's the Midianites who sold him for the 20 silvers.
And they never mention in the text anywhere that the brothers had money or the brothers.
They sold something to buy. May I read to you just a little bit from my Rebbe Nechama Leibovitz? May God rest his soul. Talking about Rashbam. He observes, these are her words in explicating Rashbam, therefore, that even Rashi's explanation, Rashi was the explanation that although in sentence 28 the subject is the Midianites, although it doesn't mention the brothers, it means that the brothers had lifted him up and that a whole thing. He observes, therefore, that even Rashi's explanation that it was the brothers who drew him out can only be accepted if we take it in the sense that the Midianites did the drawing out and at the brothers' behest. Since this too is false, Rashbam advances the revolutionary but apt explanation that Joseph was